Thank you for coming, and thank you for Rashida for inviting me to take part in the program. Thank you to the Saba Museum. I'm going to read an excerpt today from an essay that appeared in the Southern Review Literature magazine, and I'll get started. It's called In Search of My Father's Kitchens, and it focuses on my father, Joe Louis Petty. In Search of My Father's Kitchens. I must have seen the kitchen at my grandmother's, but I only remember her house in Parrish, Alabama, as it was from the outside, small, whitewashed, A-frame, and bordered by a garden of fresh, bright flowers. When we pulled up, Grandma Maddie was on the front porch with my aunts Mary and Annabelle. Everyone else in the family, uncles, aunts, and a host of rip-running cousins, filled the whole corner yard. I'd met my grandmother once before when she came to Chicago after my baby sister was born, but the big family reunion is the only encounter that I can halfway recall. It's the second and final time I'd meet her. The meeting itself was straightforward. We hugged hello. After that, I raced back down the stairs and into the fray with my sisters and cousins. What did we eat that day? Picnic food. Uncle Book probably kept things simple with hot dogs and burgers. My aunts fixed potato salad and coleslaw. And for dessert, we ate platefuls of Grandma Maddie's from scratch peach cobbler. Of this detail, I've been certain for the past 30-odd years. But my father knows better. He says that peach cobbler came later that weekend, when we visited Auntie out in the countryside. Auntie was the one with the orchards. Besides, he says, Mama wasn't much for fixing desserts. She baked buttermilk biscuits. Daddy ate them hot with sorghum. And she made meatloaf with vegetables fresh from the garden, turnip greens, collards, okra, crowder peas. Sunday dinner was chicken dinner, always. She could fry yard bird like no one else. Grandma Maddie was the mother of 9 children in all. Her husband, my grandfather, who passed years before I was born, was a coal miner and a preacher at Shady Grove Baptist. Maddie helped make ends meet as a domestic worker, cleaning and cooking in nearby Jasper, Alabama, the county seat. Yearning to know her, I try to imagine her long days. I try to fathom what they demanded. I find myself wondering whether she made cobblers for those white families who hired her. Reluctantly, I figure she must have. My father learned to cook at a place called the Old Smokehouse. 16 years old, Daddy worked the grill as a short order cook. He also waited tables, washed dishes, swept and mopped the floors, and took out the trash. He got the job through his mother, who worked for the Studdards. It was Nancy Studdard who dated Johnny Mac Colin, the owner of the smokehouse. An entrepreneur, Johnny Mac sold furniture as a traveling salesman. He also fancied himself a disc jockey and musician. On WWB, the local station out of Jasper, he played country music, including a single he wrote and pressed onto a 45. Let's go up like Moody's goose, flying high and running. Daddy listened again and again, and the lyrics confused him. He couldn't make out if Johnny Mac was singing to someone he called Baby or Phoebe. Between songs, Johnny Mac hiked the smokehouse, trying to drum up some business with his booming nasal voice. I'm on down to the old smokehouse, he boasts, and Joe Louis will cook you a hamburger. It annoyed my father, being invoked that way by Johnny Mac Colin. It also annoyed him how Johnny Mac teased him on the job, implying that he made extra large portions for himself when Johnny Mac wasn't looking. My father kept the job at the smokehouse for one summer, saving up for his return to junior college in Selma. Of course, Dad would find work in Selma too, waiting tables at the local country club. He served for special events, balls and weddings, formals. He said it was there he learned about rich folks. And of course, he learned about fine foods too. Shrimp cocktail, for filet mignon. And man, did I love that garlic bread. When my father met my mother, he courted her with fried chicken sandwiches. The two of them would walk to High Pockets before curfew. A few blocks from campus, High Pockets was on the main floor of an old shotgun house on Battle Street. It was the only dining establishment in town where black people could go. Just a snack shop, Daddy says, and the sandwiches were so good. I picture my parents young. I imagine them shy and hungry at a small pine wood table in a crowded room. Mama, the soprano coquette, Daddy, handsome and gangly, the young scientist in training. They stroll back to school, talking and laughing, taking their time, their hands grazing now and again, as if by accident. They were a scandalous pair going off that way, since it was news and known by everyone at Talladega. Mama was already pinned by another boy. Your father didn't have much, Mama says, almost 50 years later, and he spent it on me. Back in Swain Hall with their classmates, they'd be served in style. With tablecloths set in the high-ceiling dining room, select young men, fellow undergrads, elegant in short white jackets, black tie, press trousers, hoisting platters high overhead. The head waiter always led the student body in blessing the food. The summer before my father began coursework at Talladega, he spent time up north. Recruited by a farm in Wisconsin, he went to Brilliant as part of a team. About 30 young men journeyed from Greenville, Mississippi, and lived in barracks and labored 5 days a week. To each his own job. Some went out in the fields, others cooked basic meals for the whole group. My father worked on a processing line, pulling green peas from their vines, preparing them to be canned. Daddy said the work was fine. It paid well, and he enjoyed the camaraderie with the other men. Most importantly, it was an adventure that got him out of Dixie. Sometimes, after hours, he and the guys would go to the town tavern for a beer and a meal. There they were treated like celebrities, the only black faces for miles and miles. On some nights, they didn't have to pay for a thing. One time, my father and a friend showed up at the tavern during a wedding reception. The place was packed, the mood festive. Daddy stepped up to the bar and was soon approached by a man and his young son. The man and my father warmly exchanged greetings, and then the man turned to his son, who was maybe 6 or 7 years old. See, the father said, I told you they knew how to talk. Daddy laughed every time he told one of us girls when we asked to hear the tale. We found it funny and appalling, but he seemed nothing but fond of the memory. When I ask him about the summer in Wisconsin now, he tells me just a bit more. He's sure they never ate a single pea in the mess hall at the farm. He found the Wisconsin countryside lovely. He wasn't paid hourly. He was paid a flat rate. He went on 2 or 3 dates with a young white woman from Brilliant. Lisa was her name, if memory serves. She was nice, he replies when my mother asks him if he knows he could have been killed for simply looking the girl's way. I felt safe, he says and shrugs. After Brilliant, he traveled farther north to Door County. I just wasn't ready to go back south, he admits. He worked alongside Mexican families, picking cherries, but he only stayed a week or two. The harvest was dwindling, and the pay barely covered his living expenses. On the eve of the bus trip that would take him back to Alabama, he spent the night in the Sturgeon Bay town jail. He explained to the jailer that he was short on money and needed a place to sleep. The cot was comfortable, and the building was perfectly quiet. Church mouse poor in their new city. My parents gladly took to hot dogs. Mama said she didn't know how she could have eaten so many and not gained a pound. Eventually, they'd branch out to the amazing white shrimp on 63rd and the delectable barbecue at Lim's. When they went to the Loop to see a movie, they splurged afterwards at Ronnie's, a cheap steakhouse where the flaming grill made a technicolor light show right behind the counter. Or Plato's, a Mediterranean joint that seemed especially exotic. In Chicago, my parents could finally enjoy eating out, not just picking up something hot and fast, but slowing down, dressing up, being seated, enjoying the bread and the circus. Having both grown up in small towns, they had little experience as guests in restaurants. By the dictates of Jim Crow, they were banned from white-owned businesses down south. On rare occasion, Mama had been to a few nice black restaurants in Little Rock in Atlanta. But Daddy hadn't made it to Birmingham, which surely had a few of its own, and he hadn't had spare change for a true restaurant in Selma. When they hankered down from down-home vigils in Chicago, they'd go to Gladys's for smothered pork chops, mustard greens, potato pie. Renowned and popular with blue-collar folks, business people, and politicians alike, Gladys's was a scene. The more subdued Isola's was their regular spot. Right on 79th, it was their neighborhood mainstay. Isola and her sister Zenobia greeted them like family. For breakfast after church, grits, eggs, biscuits, ham, Isola's dining room filled with ladies and crowns. For dinner, my father favored the pot roast. My mother adored the liver with onions. Mama didn't learn to cook until she had a kitchen of her very own. Despite the fact that she taught full-time, she managed to create hot suppers almost every single night when I was growing up. Some meals were more labor-intensive than others. There was the pot food of red beans, black-eyed peas, neck bones, cabbage, greens, and the parade of casseroles, tetrazzini, mazzotti, tamale pie. And then there were the more involved commitments, fried chicken, fish, shrimp creole, jambalaya, the once-a-year project of chitlins. Whenever my father cooked fancy, my mother and we girls called him Chef Rocket, after the serious-minded cook on Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. Daddy would whip up broiled steak with sautéed mushrooms and peppery mashed potatoes on the side. He was versatile, manning the Weber grill in the summertime and pulling together bologna sandwiches fried and Campbell's soup on rainy Sunday afternoons. Most of all, he enjoyed fixing breakfast, grits with cheese, and something he called parish-style eggs. Very well done. My father's eggs were prepared with his understanding of certain chemical properties as inspiration. Lecturing us as he lifted a spatula and then set it back to scrambling the eggs, he explained that oxygen needed to be released from the yolks at specific intervals. For a while, he had the three of us fooled, but as we grew older, we became skeptical. Over time, parish style evolved into our code word for scorched or burned food. You could count on my father to eat these items with no complaint. He actually seemed to enjoy them. And then there were the special occasions when my father brought food home from work, meals in foil pouches, shrimp for one dinner, steak for another. These were test rations that had been concocted at the government lab. As a wannabe astronaut, I downed the food with glee and gusto. Rations for the military, my mother tells me now. Yeah, the shrimp was good, but I don't know what I was thinking letting Joe bring that in the house. The package said to call a veterinarian in case of emergency. I've done nothing extravagant when I've cooked for my parents. My mother insists on running the show at Thanksgiving and Christmas. As her sous chef, I'm authorized to rustle up salads, do basic preps for cornbread stuffing, prepare the sweet potato pudding. I'm proud to report that I've impressed them with a completely from scratch peach cobbler. I've also taken them out on the town, often to places that employ chefs rather than cooks. This kind of indulgence, my gift, my treat, is also a message. See, I'm grown now.
I can do this for you. I'll stop there. Thank you. Well, I don't know how I kid called Chitlins. Chitterlings. And Chitlins were the residue left out of pigs. And what we find as we look at the continuation of diets in every racial or ethnic group across the world, they had to, particularly if they were not the dominant group, their, you know, the ultimate objective of all life is food, clothing, and shelter. And food may be the most important of all these. But if the dominant group controls the land, they will perhaps control what is going to be produced on the land. We're seeing this now all over the world, as those who control take the land and utilize it for things beside food. Now, my daddy, my heritage comes, I'm not a scholar, I'm not an academic, I'm not a, you know, any of those things, so I'm just talking because I've lived a long time. My daddy, parents and my mother's parents were former slaves, and they were sharecroppers, and in that sharecropping, which is another form of slavery, they had to learn how to do not just sharecrop for the persons who dominated the land, but on the little bit of land that they had some access to grow the kind of food that would not only fill them, but nourish them to continue for the next day. And so they did that. And those foods were primarily the thing that they, Audrey just described in many ways. They took the land and turned to greens, collard greens, mustard, cabbage, and all those kinds of greens. Now, my daddy, when we moved to Chicago, and I don't know very much about farming at all, but when we moved to Chicago, my daddy had one theme that he would use with my mother. And he said, "Maddie, pay rent, buy plenty of food, and toilet paper." Which meant food had to be, you know, taken care of that later on. And so what I learned from them is that we had a garden. Wherever we lived, there was a patch of land that would be set aside for a garden. Now, my father, when he first came to Chicago, worked in the steel mill, but later transferred to the stockyards. And there he could acquire pork, beef, all kinds of meats. And in the garden, they would grow small quantities of greens, lettuce, cabbage, and in some instances, because my mother and her sisters do, apples, oranges, grapes. And then my uncle, one of my uncles from Alabama, but from outside Alabama, in Pratt City, in what they call a small black community, they would send us chickens by the cage, because they thought their relatives were starving to death in Chicago. But they had the food, and they wanted their relatives who had fled south to be at least safe in terms of that. Now, in our house, and because Audrey has said it so well, those foods said to accept when you were going, what you were going to eat, what you were going to put on in the morning. When we were going to school, we got up, we had oatmeal, cornflakes, milk, an apple, an orange, went off to school. Before that, my mother would have gotten up 5 o'clock in the morning, cooked breakfast for my daddy, and then fixed him a bag lunch. And that would be bologna, salami, fruit, some sort of salad. And he would go and have lunch. And then in the evening, when he returned, we would have dinner during the weekdays, pork chops, some form of beef, roast beef, ground beef, or collard greens, cabbage, a salad, lemonade. And the most important thing that we would have to consume during that session, where everyone in the family was expected to be, everyone in the immediate family, we'd have relatives come with the immediate family, my brother, my sister, myself, my mother and dad, we'd have to wait out a week at 51st and Indiana. When my daddy got off the streetcar, he used to have streetcars around Chicago. You young people may ask your grandparents about that. When he got off the streetcar, that meant it was time for me to get back home to have dinner. And with those very luscious meals that my mother cooked, she was a great cook. I learned how to cook a little bit from her experiences. The smell of the food was just inviting. You wanted to see how they put that together. We would talk about why we ate this beautiful food. The world that we lived in. My dad would bring his ideas of what would happen to him, steal him, stock up, and how he'd been treated. Meanwhile, we were talking. And my mother was like his therapist. She would fix the food specifically to help my father feel better about the day that he spent. My brother and I would share those emotions while we were eating and smiling at one another. It was not just the consumption of the food. It was the conversation and the sharing, but the food initiated. Because we would run home to get some food that mom was cooking. We didn't want to do this, that home cooking, as we called it in those days. Now called soul food. And then through the week, as we ate, my brother and I would come home for lunch. In those days, it was safe to come home from school, from the elementary school for lunch. And mom would have some soup that she had made, and she would have a sandwich and something sweet. And then we would enjoy it so much that we knew that our mother loved us, because if she didn't, she wouldn't cook so well. The emotions that went with the meal made the meal taste much better than the evening. And then the weekend, Sunday, get up, have breakfast while you talk and pray. Now, I didn't pray that much, I ate more. But the prayer that went along with the breakfast, with the amen, and then on to the religious experience, and back home for lunch. Preparation for dinner, chicken, duck, ham, whatever the meat happened to be, always prepared with feelings of it has to be good for my family. Then while my mother was cooking, or sometimes she and my father would engage in songs, spirituals, steal away, steal away. But the spiritual I've gotten was steal away to jam on. It ain't, it's I'm here, but I'm gonna be all right. A kind of a positive attitude while they were cooking and laughing. My mother sang kind of an alto, my dad was a bass baritone, and I tried to come in sometime with my little tongue. while we were munching before we actually eat. That Sunday, all of the family had to be home if they were in town, or they would feel that they would feel like they had betrayed trust. And so the food which she brought, when you say feed the hungry goes beyond just the consumption of a product from the earth. That product from the earth helps. The nutrition is important. But the preparation and the relationship from those, and that's the reason when blacks began to go out to restaurants, same food, but a harmonious relationship. Armin Lewis, Isola, who is not well now. Before Isola, there was Bernoulli's on 61st Street. And we wild guys, when we come home from a dance or a party, we would stop in there. You might see Duke Ellington come in that restaurant because he liked home food too. Calloway and on. And so the transference, when I look today and we see the vacant land, which could feed, help feed, but yet people don't have that agricultural background or experience. Some of those are beginning to reappear in some places. During World War II, when food was scarce all over the United States, are so expensive you couldn't afford it. There was an encouragement to create victory gardens on the land. You ask your older relatives about that. They did have beautiful victory gardens, and with those victory gardens came conversation and friendship. And then when I returned from service, there were celebrations in the neighborhood around these victory gardens as these people prepared this sumptuous food that has earlier been described. So I see food as a vehicle not only for the maintenance and sustenance of living, but an opportunity for people to share their feelings, their experiences, and carry those not just from their relatives or their ancestors, but forward to another generation. In France, used to take, at least I haven't been there in a while now, a couple of hours to eat a meal, because it was more than just the meal. It was relationships that went with the meal. Transference of our experience from the South, from slavery to sharecropping, to the life of segregation, discrimination, and all of the things that went with that period of time. We could share the feeling that one day, because we were not hungry, that we would be able to have the strength, the courage, and acquire the knowledge to make a change in the world that we live in. And some of us that continue to do that throughout most of our lifetime. I saw this in France, in Germany, in Holland, places where I had to be and volunteer to go there. But again, it was the food. When I waded into Normandy, June the 8th, figures out the deal. And I got on the beach and I said, Monsieur, you're part of the front seat. And the other part was, do you have anything to eat? Oh, oui, Monsieur. Then you see, food, the basis of life, social, cultural, and candy, political, and economic. Thank you very much.
Lives were under attack, and they lost everything. And when we think about poverty now, generational poverty too, we have to think back to those times as well as what led to what happened now. My own personal family, still to this day, you know, without land and without access to resources. And I can trace back to that. The same thing I found out happened on my father's side, I just found out recently as well. So those kinds of things that contribute to how, you know. And so I want us to think about trauma that we went through and what that means. And then Tim talked about sharecropping. And there's a lot of shame associated with working the land and the trauma that we endured. And so we have to remember that too. And so now as an activist, I'm very concerned about how disconnected our people have become and have been from the very thing that roots us and that grounds us in who we are. We are a land-based people. We've been severed horrifically from the very land, you know, that is our foundation. And we see that manifested in so many ways, including our health. So the trauma that we're seeing also, that historical trauma, but also contemporary trauma as well that we continue to go through because we're severed, we're marginalized, we face all kinds of, you know, issues as we all know. So I just wanted to kind of, you know, talk about that, my personal story in terms of migration and just the reality that it wasn't voluntary, right? It was very forced, and there's a lot of trauma behind it. And afterwards, you know, the diet obviously changes as well, too. And so I'd love for us to get into a discussion later in the Q&A about, you know, how I just have a lot of questions, right? So the research that I've been doing, I do a lot of research around just basically, you know, what does colonization mean and how does that affect us, and then specifically how we're eating and how that's further incarcerating us. And so my question is, you know, I know that we have a history of growing food, and we talk about a lot of the way that the so-called soul food or home-based diet, what do you call home-cooked meal, home-cooked diet, how that narrative became into a lot of unhealthy ways of eating. So the fried chicken, the, you know, the chitlins, and just all the stuff that really, quite frankly, clogs our arteries and is leading to the deterioration of our health. It's killing us, right? So why is all the stuff that's killing us being kept as the narrative about what our culture is, but the good stuff gets left out, right? And so, like, the beans and the reality is, you know, when our ancestors were enslaved, many of us had gardens and grew food. And, you know, I didn't find that out again until research later, because that wasn't part of the narrative. We don't hear that part of it. So how did that get left out? And then, you know, so why is all the good stuff left out and then all the other stuff gets, you know, kind of adopted as our culture? So that's my question. I don't have an answer, but I'm just, you know, I have theories, but I'd like to talk about that later. So what I do now, so I've been working on, it's called Healthy Food Hub. And I also work on a project called Fresh Foods. And I just love the Healthy Food Hub, which is every other Saturday at Betty Chabot's International Charter School. I want to give a shout out. And I also work on a new project called Fresh Foods. And before I talk about it, I actually have a quick clip, and I think I see Sheila. I want to give her a shout out. She's one of the founders of Fresh Foods here, which is a mobile produce market. What we're doing is bringing fresh produce to communities that have been historically marginalized, and specifically on the west side of Chicago we've been working on. So I want to play a quick clip, actually featuring Sheila. Haha. You're so famous. I'm lying. Thank you.
Diabetes?
Food.
Heart disease, right. Food and stress-related illnesses, right? I think we forget stress a lot, but and it's critical that we think about that. Actually, there's another article that just came out in, I think, Clutch magazine that talked about food is not the only thing that's killing us. We have got to think about psychological trauma that relates to why we eat the way we eat as well. So mental health is definitely connected to it, but the reality is that there's a lot of that the way that we're eating or not able to eat is the problem or is contributing to us dying, right? And I think a lot of people frame it in terms of why we're choosing to eat what we eat. But the reality is that, again, my background is community development, and so I'm always thinking about place. Like, what does our place look like, and how does that then shape our so-called decisions, right? And so if I only have a Popeyes, Church's Chicken, and McDonald's, and nothing else, what kind of choices do I really have, right? And so, and no shout-outs to them. I did not mean to, I'm not so maybe, like, believe that, because I'm not trying to, I'm not trying to promote any more advertising, because they don't need any more advertising than they already get, but the reality is, if we only have fast food, then, you know, what are we getting? So we're bringing produce in the community, and I just want to show this clip, because I think it's great. And I love Sheila.
I think you gotta pull it back.
Pull it back.
Pull that back.
Oh,
yeah. Pull back to the beginning.
I just want to play that. That institution or that drain resources from the community. We're working with the community to benefit from the assets that exist in the community. And one of that is Brittany. I'm going to give her a shout out. She's an intern with us, Wade Brittany. And she's actually collecting recipes from some of the seniors and some of the folks in the community. Because a lot of folks are like, don't y'all have to teach people how to eat? Like, you know, our people are just so ignorant. And, you know, it's just not, that's not the case, right? So there's a lot of resources, a lot of knowledge that exists in the community that we have to tap into. And again, that's why I'm really excited about your work, too, because it's critical that we continue to document. Our seniors always talk about freezing, canning, like how do we preserve food? And with our generation, we lost that, right? So how do we get that back? And so there's so much to be done, so many discussions to be had about why we eat the way we do, why resources are the way they are, where's the equity, where's the justice, you know, and how are we caring for ourselves and caring for each other in the community, which is really critical. So I wanted to end by just some authors and scholars and folks who inspire me and the work that I do. I wanted to play a quick clip from Soul Food Junkies, but I ran out of time. But there's a movie called, have you heard about Soul? Yeah.
I see it.
You want to see the, but if time permits, I often pull it up and we can show it. But there's a new documentary coming out by Byron Hurt called Soul Food Junkies. When it comes out, please look out for it. It's going to be incredible. And so I'm going to give Byron Hurt a shout out. And he talks to all of my heroes and sheroes in this, which is like Vermeer Rosner. He talks to Frederick Douglass Olpe. There's his brother Brian Terry who wrote something about it. So what they're trying to do is change, like, in a healthier way, you know, how we're thinking about keeping culture, you know, but healthy and loving. And so that's it.
Educating people to try things. It was just amazing to see that young man eat that apple, you know. But that, with Walmart coming into the community, providing more fresh vegetables and stuff, if people don't abuse them, if they don't buy them, you know, what's the next step? How can we move back the education around food?
I think that's a great question. Dorothy, would you like to start with you?
You actually reminded me that there's something that I really needed to write about and did not really quickly, which is that when we talk about access, I think we misdiagnose the problem, which is not that there are not these major corporations that are present in the community, or grocery stores, rather. And so when we think about that, then we turn to Walmart and think of that as a solution, which a lot of people with Walmart, Walgreens, you know, these company stores, hospitals, save a lot. But the reality is that there needs to be a lot more community-driven solutions to the problem as well. So that, and those community-driven solutions need to be supported. My critique of like a lot of the grocery stores, and I saw a quote here at McDonald's, the question, if I come in and I'm used to fries for fries, and when you walk into a McDonald's, what do you smell?
Right.
What are you advertising in the community? What, you know, so we're being constantly primed all day, every day, with junk food and destructive foods. So there does have to be a lot of work to capture that. But, you know, I feel like it's really easy for the corporations and folks to say, you know, well, we're offering the good stuff, but folks ain't choosing the bad stuff. Exactly. And you're constantly advertising the bad stuff.
Right.
You know, you're constantly marketing. You have a multi-billion-dollar, you know, budget to be marketing all the stuff that's killing us. And so it's just a constant indoctrination that, is going to have to be countered somehow. It's just going to be a lot of work. But, you know, my first thought is just, you know, what's being advertised, be it through the smells, you know, when you come in the door, the placement, like what's on sale, what's on special. Like, I can take grocery stores are, you know, you can have a grocery store here, but if the first things that you see are like junk food and chips and processed foods, and then you got to go all the way in the back to see, like, you know, I mean, the produce, what are you really marketing, and what kind of behavior?
Well, ultimately, the solution comes from you folks out there and the folks from home. My mother and dad dictated because they had the experience through slavery and the other experiences of deprivation, of knowing the kind of food that was available and expanding that when they got a chance for their children. And they demanded that their children eat that. I mean, they were nice about it. But we knew we were not going to be dealing with junk food. Junk food was available, but it did not proliferate. We were playing when we ate some food from those kind of places that had that quick food. We better not talk to mom and dad too much about us having done that. In other words, there was a discipline involved that is lacking now. And we have to recover that from some place. Maybe it's the minister. Maybe it's the teacher. If the teacher can understand the relationship of food and learning in the child. That's where we can't let those who are making millions and billions of dollars out of exploiting us with that cheap food do this, because our children don't know any better because they don't have any background for the most part. So that is a huge responsibility, because when we look at the mortality rates and when we look at the hospitalization and we begin to look at that, they all are related. You see, I didn't get to be 92 just because the genes were good. I had a discipline of food which carried you not just through mine, from my mother and father, but to the next generation. Talking about what's good to eat. And until we can really define what's good to eat for our young people, they will get what somebody tells them.
I was going to say, Mr. Black, and I think that's an excellent traditions among African Americans in terms of, we could almost call it like new soul foods or new ideas about what constitutes home cooking. You know, you see, like you mentioned, Brian Terry has a cookbook that deals with the vegan vegetarian soul food. But I'm wondering, are there some trends in food that you're seeing? You know, is there an emergent awareness about food health and food quality? I'd love to know your thoughts.
She didn't get there. She was at Aldi's and jewels or places like that. My mother died 3 months ago from ovarian cancer, and it was because of the things she eat. You know, as a Black community, cancer and things like that are because of food we eat and the stress we have. So my whole thing is, it took her to be about to die for us to start solely shopping at organic places, because that's all she could eat as going through fighting cancer. So you have to reach a younger crowd, and it's work that Dara's doing, like organizing, going out into the streets. If you present it to us in a way that's presentable, we will eat it. Like, don't get me wrong, the apple is powerful. But I could go out on the street right now and hand a kid an apple, and they're like, what? No, I'm not gonna eat that. If I cut the apple up, made it appetizing, and showed them something that it's cool to eat, they would eat it. You have to make it presentable to my age, because we're the ones about to die. There are 23-year-olds, 21-year-olds, 22-year-olds getting cancer and dying. I don't think any previous generation has experienced that. I'm ignorant to that, but I can say off the bat, we're not dying as quickly as we're dying now. So you have to make that presentable. You have to go out into the street. You have to throw fresh fruit and shove it down people's because we can't. We're going extinct because of what we eat. And bags of chips are 25 cents. The apple is 169. A 7-year-old is going to go and get that cream pie with the, what is that, corn syrup, starch, whatever.
High fructose.
They're going to get that Hubs juice that was 20 cents, and not that apple juice that was $2. And they're going to get those chips. And it's poison. And it's not only causing them to die in a few years, it's causing ADHD. And then they get kicked out of school and their life is ruined because of something they ate. And that's what we have to notice. Food is destroying all aspects of life, all aspects of living.
So I was also gonna just comment that I think the fact that, in relation to what you're pointing out, like the fact that First Lady Michelle Obama has begun this school, this initiative nationwide in schools to really begin the conversation with younger people about nutrition, I think is really crucial. And just in the interest of time, this is going to be our last question, but my hope is that as we exit the venue, maybe we'll have time for some more conversation and discussion one-on-one, even outside of the auditorium, because I think there's a lot of discussion, so please come.
I'm headed to a family reunion after this, and I know they're going to be cutting it up, you know, a lot of the classic soul food, and how do you go, you know, back to the family, and I say, oh, I can't do that, you know, when, you know, eating is a thing that, you know, bonds us together, like, we're whole now again after so many years of not seeing each other, so, you know, so, and then once you start, you're not going to, like, you know, just gonna keep going, you know, I know it's like an individual thing, like, okay, I'm not going to indulge too much in that, you know, but it's like breaking bread, you know,
and
yeah. Oh, I have to go empty-handed.
I want you to live longer.
Thank you.
It's a healthy dish. Share. They say this is what I eat, because it's always about growing and sharing. You don't have to eat the same way you did when you were 7. Just, you know.
Yeah, I think they're gonna like dig that, but you know, they won't.
They'll try. Try theirs and then try yours.
Thanks.
One appetite at a time. Yesterday, my Margaret is a local artist and musician, and he and I were talking about family reunions as a little staple of our family culture. And I'm thinking, this could be an exciting project, if those of us who are trying to know about nutrition, if we show up with some organic food, some kale, or, you know, some bags of garlic, and some this and some that, I mean, just saying, okay, guys, you know, some chitlins, some macaroni and cheese, God bless it, but you can still have these alternatives and have our flavorful. Feel satisfied. So I think there
true.
Yeah, I am.
I was just thinking about that. Like, your generation and younger, you all don't know how to cook. The ones that are being exposed to all this.
Let mom finish talking.
I just didn't want to take up all the time is we can talk to people. We can talk to our parents all the time. But today's economy, does not provide the time to explain the way we want to do exactly. Today's economy, the capitalist structure does not provide the time for you to do
exactly.
So you die quicker, and then you get a life insurance company, or you get sick quicker, so they can throw in their pharmaceutical company, which is going to soak you until you're dry and kill you.
That's right.
That's how we're built. We're built to get sick so we can feed into the government and the pharmaceutical company and the capitalist structure. Kids nowadays make their own meals.
Right.
And we wouldn't like to think that in a perfect world, we would like to say, oh, these kids aren't cooking their own meals. They're children. Parents at home. Parents are at work.
Right, exactly.
Parents are at work. Parents are doing things trying to stay alive. And kids are coming home from school and popping in microwave meals. They're popping in, breaking open bags, ramen noodles.
Right.
If they're a little fancy, they'll get the Alfredo pack.
Right.
Like, kids are the ones making their own meals. And if I can show a kid, now kids 16, 17, 18, I'm 19. So those are my friends. I have a barbecue about once a month. Everything's organic. Still have meat, but I still have organic meat.
Okay.
If they just have to have meat. I take a different college kid right before they go to college. Three times I take them to Whole Foods.
Okay.
About seven college kids will only shop at Whole Foods. And they get their food straight. And they're like, no way am I going back to my house. It feels better. And you can think that you have to sneak kids food. But kids know when they feel for them.
Right.
We know when it's a better feeling in our body. And so, you have to reach a younger crowd. You can't talk about Patti LaBelle and the 23-year-olds that the 23-year-old hipsters where it's fashionable. It's fashionable for us to go into a Whole Foods now. We're like, oh yeah, we're cool. We drink smoothies, we eat broccoli, you know. We're down, we're hot. Like, it's fashionable. We're talking about kids. Those are the ones that are dying.
I just wanted to say, you move my heart. You're right, reaching young people. You are. By the time they get my age, they want to tell me I got diabetes, so I need medication.
Come on, this way. Show me how you walk across the stage. Walk across the stage.
The home cooked meal thing. And I was trying to follow my heart.
Mama did, my mama did the same thing.
You know, my mom told me, if you have this this one was killer. My mom was about 260 pounds. She was like, this obesity is going to kill me.
Right.
And if you don't be healthy, I'm like, and now. Okay.
And I'm sorry about your mama. I really am. You continue on in her legacy with the job that you're doing, sweetie. This is a flyer advertising a video showing. We're showing Migration, the musical. We're going to show have a video showing here on August 27th.
Okay.
Come on, we're asking check that out. Everyone leave the theater at this time.
Yo. You have to go do that.